For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we've been banged up. Inspired by a recent addition to the Talking Books Library, today we're looking at literature behind bars. We hear about a prisoner of war escaping execution by surviving the Dresden bombings. Rachel Kushner talks about her jail novel, The Mars Room, and real-life UK prisoner Erwin James talks about learning Braille in jail. All that and more on today's Read On. A few weeks back in the new books feature, we heard about Inside Parkhurst by David Berridge. Here's Lynn Livingston.
We were recently given this true crime book by Stephen Dials in the Hachette Group. Inside Parkhurst was written by David Berridge. During his 28 years working as a prison officer, David Berridge has had to deal with it all. Serial killers and gangsters, terrorists and sex offenders, psychopaths and addicts. Inside Parkhurst is his raw, uncompromising look at what really goes on behind the massive walls and menacing gates. Thrown in at the deep end, David quickly had to work out how to deal with the most cunning and volatile of prisoners and to learn how to avoid their many scams. He's been assaulted and abused. He's tackled cell fires and attempted suicides, riots and dirty protests. He's helped to foil escape plans, talked inmates down from rooftop protests, witnessed prisoners setting fire to themselves, and prevented prisoners from attempting to murder other prisoners. And now, he takes us inside this secret world for the first time.
And Lynn will have four more new gems at the end of today's show. But inspired by Inside Parkhurst, let's listen to three very different audiobooks about life inside. Erwin James is the author of three books, the first of which, A Life Inside, A Prisoner's Notebook, is available from RNIB, and is a compilation from his Guardian columns, which were written while still incarcerated. We spoke at a book festival about his book, Redeemable, A Memoir of Darkness and Hope.
Well, it's a book, it's a hard account of how I became who I became, from the sort of earliest beginnings, through a really challenging sort of life journey to disaster and failure, and then basically how I sort of crawled out of the deepest hole imaginable and managed to become, I think, who I should have been. I guess in a nutshell, that's what it's about.
You talked about prison libraries.
Well, prison libraries, Christ, you know, I was so grateful for prison libraries. But I was grateful that I could read. You know, so many people in prison, they can't read. I didn't know that. I didn't know when I went into prison that I had the edge on so many of my fellow prisoners just because I could read. And the prison library, they were lifesavers, prison library, in terms of books just to enjoy, but also books to make me think, books to educate myself. You know, I needed books. I was hungry for books all the time.
And you're still serving your sentence?
Well, I am, because I got a life sentence. I was convicted of murder. And I deservedly got a life sentence. But, you know, what happens is when you get a life sentence, you serve a term in custody. And then if you sort of behave and demonstrate that there's some change or some progress in your life and you're not going to be a risk to the public, eventually you get a chance. You know, I'm so grateful that I live in a country prepared to give someone like me a second chance. But we give people second chances in this country. And I got my second chance after 20 years.
We've recently on the show been talking to Irvine Welsh about his book Blade Artist. Have you heard about Blade Artist?
I've heard about it. I've not read it, yeah.
But Begbie becomes a reformed character in prison and becomes an artist. Do you think you are the sort of the real life version of that fiction?
Well, sort of, because I was a pretty amoral character. I'm not going to lie to you. There's not, you know, I was so far away from civilized society, as you know, my criminal lifestyle was just appalling. It's absolutely appalling, and I couldn't imagine living like that now. That's the strange thing. When I was lived like that, I used to look at normal, you know, nice people who lived in nice houses and think, how do you get to live in a house like that? How do you get to be a part of a community where you have a purpose and a meaning? And I didn't know how to do that. And yet now I live like that, and I don't know how I lived when I lived on the streets. I don't know how I managed that. I couldn't do it now.
And in prison, you did some Braille transcription.
Well, when I first went in, I mean, I'd had a job. They put me in an engineering workshop, but all my job was just filing down lumps of metal. So I just sit all 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, just filing lumps of metal. And we had to do these psychology tests, psychological assessments. And then an officer came to my cell door one day and he said, the tests that you've done show that you might have an aptitude for Braille transcription. They had this little Braille unit, you know. And I didn't know what Braille was. But I went and did a test. And then, you know, within a couple of weeks, I was doing this thing called the Braille Primer. You know what the primer is. And I worked through that. And it was in prison, it was the best job I ever had. You have this little thing, this little Perkins Braille machine with six keys. And there was a dozen of us in this Braille unit. And you know, people who couldn't see would send requests in for books or for things that they wanted to transcribe. And what I loved doing, one of my favourite things was doing, was when there was an image or a picture that needed description. So me as a writer, you know, because don't forget, I didn't know I was a writer then, but I loved doing those, you know, narrative descriptions of images and pictures. But I loved that job. Even when I look back now, it's making me smile because I was in prison and I was paying my penance and trying to, you know, make some sense of it. And I was given an opportunity to provide such an amazing service for people. It's very humbling that I was doing this. I used to do a book a week sometimes, you know, to blast away like a madman on this Perkins machine. In fact, the 12 of us in this Braille unit were all doing long prison sentences. But all you could hear, all the bash, 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 and these keys going away. And it was a fantastic job, honestly. It was a pleasure to do that.
And we've got something in common. We've both transcribed the TV guide.
Yeah, a brilliant TV guide. It was sometimes annoying when there wasn't much description of the programme. I think they need more than that. And I'd try to add a little bit more colour to it so that people could understand what the programme was about. But
did you have a TV at the time in your cell while you were doing that?
My first 14 years, there was no TV. And then in 1998, 1999, they brought televisions into prisons. And I'll be honest with you, I had mixed feelings about it because on the one hand, it took away the mental isolation of a prison cell. I could now, you know, project my mind and thoughts to a screen. And what, you know, trouble is I became addicted to Coronation Street. So, you know, you go to prison and even now I'm still a mad Coronation Street fan because I looked forward to that. You know, the banal normality of everyday life, which you don't get in prison. Prison's just one long challenging struggle to survive. But Coronation Street was always, because I remembered Coronation Street before I went to prison. So there was sort of a civilized link there. So television, I like to read in prison, you see, and television, in a way, can make you a little bit lazy, but I was grateful to see the outside world through a television screen, if I'm honest.
Was that not a special kind of torture, like making you do the TV guide when you couldn't watch the programmes yourself?
Well, in a way it was, because we had television rooms, so you could watch you had association in the evenings until about 8 o'clock, so you could watch TV till 8 o'clock, but you never saw the late-night programmes. You never saw the late news or programmes with a bit of a thriller or something like that. You never saw that sort of stuff. It could be a bit frustrating. We think, wish I could see that. But, you know, it was just a joy to do that work.
And you mentioned in your talk there was a riot within a riot when someone, during a riot, smashed the TV.
Yeah, nobody could believe it. What the hell did he smash the TV? Because now we're totally isolated from the outside world. We had one television on the wing. And somebody went and smashed it during the riot, but it was the least of my worries that night, I've got to tell you.
Now, you ended up, while still inside, being a Guardian columnist. How did that come about?
Well, just coincidences, you know. I met a probation officer whose next-door neighbour was a writer, and I used to read this writer's book. His name was Ronan Bennett. And when I told the probation officer, he suggested I write to Ronan, just a sort of fan letter sort of thing, you know, appreciating his money. And I did that, and we ended up having a friendship. And then he knew somebody at The Guardian who they were talking about having a prisoner, a long-term prisoner. How do we get a long-term prisoner who can write for the newspaper to tell us what prison's like? And Ronan said, well, I know a guy. And so, you know, recommended me. Of course, then I had to do it. It's one thing fantasizing about being a writer, a professional writer, when you can write a good letter, because I was the prisoner that could write a good letter. Then when the opportunity came and I had to sit and write 800 words, first of all every fortnight and then every week, and I had to bring in he had to be interesting, he had to have colour, he had to have information, he had to be entertaining, he had to have some moral value, you know. And it was a hell of a challenge, I've got to tell you, but it took some discipline. The thing about writing is it takes a lot of discipline writing. And of course, people would read my column in sort of 5 or 6 minutes, but it might take me all day to write it. Sometimes it took me 2 or 3 days to write that column, you know. And sometimes I'd look at the paper and think, I wish words would come. I couldn't think of anything to write about, you know. I was always hoping for a scandal or a riot or some sort of gossip. I used to ask my two pals, Big Rinty and Felix the Gambler, say, any scandal, any gossip? I need something for my column this week, you know. But that was amazing, that was.
You also mentioned in vivid detail what your cell looked like on the first day that you arrived in prison. Is that sort of burned into your memory?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, my first book was called A Life Inside, and the jacket cover is just a bare cell with a bed and there's not even a table and a chair there in the image. And there's a cell high up on the back wall, and it looks exactly like my prison cell. But, I mean, I deserved to be there, but the thing was, it was pretty bleak and grim. It was just flaking emulsion paint, sort of light green stained flaky emulsion paint on the walls, with this small window on the back wall high up, with three sets of bars on the window, and a cot bed with a very very thin, very stained mattress, and half a sponge pillow, a table, chair, and a bed, and a bucket for my toilet. That was it, you know. That was it.
Do you find now that when people find out about your background that they're intimidated ever so slightly by you?
Well, I hope not, because I don't find myself I'm not an intimidating person. I don't think I am anyway. But I mean, I've got quite a shocking past. So if people know me and don't know about my past, and then they find out about my past, it can be a bit awkward, because it's quite hard to reconcile the person that I present now with this person who, you know, I was a very violent criminal. There's no question about that. I was somebody who caused a lot of pain and distress to other people. And I think marrying those two images can be quite awkward for some people, you know. It's a bit awkward for me sometimes. I think, how did I live like that, you know? But I think coming to events like this and sort of sharing this experience, it helps an audience to understand, but it helps me as well. It gives me some validation and some sense that that this is really happened. This has been a journey, and it's worth me continuing this journey, you know.
Is your level of rehabilitation available for everyone who goes into prison, do you think?
Well, I got a lucky break with the writing, so I found a skill in prison. You know, I was never a writer; I wasn't educated. But then, because I was the guy that could write a good letter, and writing became something that I really enjoyed, I developed this skill. Even then, not thinking, oh, when I get out, I'm going to be a writer. Who would think that? I mean, prison serving life. You know, I wasn't thinking when I get out, I'm going to be a writer. I was just thinking, well, this is something I can do now, and it makes me feel that I'm doing something worthwhile, and. And then I got this lucky break with The Guardian. I got out of prison after 20 years. I was a Guardian columnist. I wrote features for Radio Times. I wrote features had a column in The Big Issue. You know, I was being accepted by the writing fraternity as a writer. Mm-hmm. And then I was getting paid, you know, good money for writing. I was making a living at writing. So I never saw that coming, you know. I never saw that coming.
Erwin James, thanks so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me to talk to you.
This week on Read On, we've got Literature Locked Up, and next up is the novel The Mars Room, written by Rachel Kushner. Romy Hall, the protagonist of The Mars Room, is at the start of two consecutive life sentences at a women's correctional facility deep in California's Central Valley. Outside is the world from which she has been severed. Inside is a new reality. The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner is read by the author.
Let's start with basics. Do you know what year it is? It's... Doc did not know what year it was, but it dawned on him that he knew how to answer this stupid question. It's the year after last year. The doctor frowned. Do you know where you are? Doc looked around, saw nothing but a metal cart with pills in paper cups, an armed guard sitting on a chair. The room had no windows and there was nothing on the walls. He looked down at his body, saw a garment that was half a garment. His hand was plastered with tape holding a needle in. Tubes ran from his hand up to a metal stand with a bag hanging from it, half full of clear liquid. A person who must have been a nurse came in and eyed the bag, squeezed it in a way that seemed reckless, and walked out of the room. Doc's cuffed wrists were chained to the bed's metal rails. His ankles, too, were manacled to the bed rails. He had no clue where he was. All he knew was that his skull felt like it had been split in half by a concrete spillway. Icy water splashed through the spillway, pushing his brains apart.
Rachel Kushner, the author and narrator of The Mars Room. She joined me down the line via Skype and told me about the book.
The book is a contemporary novel which mostly tells the story of one young woman who speaks in the first person, although there are other characters. And it takes place in California, and in a way it's about contemporary California, but maybe a California that those outside California, and even some people who live there, don't really have to think about or see because of the way our society is so severely stratified, in that poor people who commit crimes and go to prison are almost structurally invisible to middle-class people. And this book starts with a woman who is on a bus traveling up a long stretch of highway from Los Angeles to the Central Valley, where we grow food in California. It's all industrial farming, and that's also where all the prisons are sited. And she's on her way to prison to serve a life sentence. And as the book unfolds, she adjusts to living life in prison, and also provides the reader with significant flashbacks of material to her earlier life in San Francisco, where she grew up.
How was the research, and how was it as a writer inhabiting that character who was serving life without the possibility of parole?
Yeah, it was intense. I do a lot of volunteer work with people who are serving life sentences in prison, and that's partly how this book evolved, was that it had a natural dialogue with my actual life. And things I'm involved with separate from writing to do with, you know, I go and watch trials because I want to see who's being subjected to the justice system, who has a lawyer, who doesn't. I live right near the courts. And I did start to wonder about what happens. You know, the court is a very public place. Anyone can go and watch a trial. But once a person is convicted, they are remanded. That's the term they use, remanded to state prison. And after that, the portion of their punishment that is unseen by the public begins. And I really wanted to follow one person on that bus and up through and into prison. And because I know people who are serving life sentences and have, you know, regular dialogues with these people, I have some sense of what it's like for them. But it's a different thing to speak in the voice of someone who's experiencing that. And I wanted to force myself to do it, partly to think into what a life sentence is. It's my character doesn't have life without possibility of parole, but she has effectively that. She has two life sentences, which means you carry out the first one and you go up for parole. And if they say you've completed your sentence, then you can begin your second sentence. And it's based on a sentence that a friend of mine actually does have, a friend who has nothing to do with the character in the book. It's just a sentence, which I found sort of galling and incredible as a sentence. I did want to think into what that means. It's quite abstract to be told that the unit of your life is the segment of time that you can use to pay back the state for the harm you've committed. And it's purely subjective, because you could live for 4 years or you could live for 40 years, but that's the amount of time you need to use to give to them in order to recalibrate your wrong and make right. I mean, I don't think that they even look at it so schematically, but effectively that's what it is. You pay back with your time, which is the only thing a lot of people have. But in writing the book, there were a lot of parts of it where mentally I wasn't inside prison, just as I assumed my character would not be, because once you go to prison, the period of life of your life where you're collecting experiences and memories from the outside world have ceased. And so I assumed it would be a time of revisiting and ruminating on those experiences, and also recounting for the reader who you are. And who you are is shaped by what happened to you before you go to prison. And people hold on to that very strongly. You know, the identity that they have is one that they've managed to acquire before they caught a case and were forced to be stripped of their identity, as the sociologist Irving Goffman would put it, you know, have their clothes taken away from them, all the things that signify a life and particularity. So she goes back in her memories and provides chapters of her childhood and adolescence in San Francisco, and then the years directly before she went to prison in Los Angeles. So that was just all kind of normal writing in a way for me, because I was telling the story of a character and she was in a milieu that I know very well. I know it personally. She's from my neighborhood where I grew up, and her friends are, it's essentially a world that I lived. Her friends are my friends. So it wasn't that exotic for me, but also I know people from growing up who went to prison. And so in a way, the book gave me the opportunity, even if it was very dark at times, to sort out some of what happened in terms of the stark distance between different destinies. You know, when you're a child, you're at least for me as an adolescent, the world of my friends was everything. I barely saw my parents. Much as I love them, they weren't involved. I was just with this group of kids. And even when you're young, there's a feeling that people are going to go in different directions. And there were people who, you know, made a courageous stance that their life was going to be about pushing back against authority. And some of that has to do with their home life. And, you know, I had a couple of friends, or many friends, who were lost to that. And one in particular who went to prison. And the difference between what happened in his life and what happened in mine, that is painful for me, but writing the book was a way somehow of processing some of those differences and that pain. But I also tried to make it a very funny book, and that's not just to include humor and entertain people, although I do hope it does that, but because I felt like I wouldn't have been getting at the truth of the matter if I didn't find the humor. Because it's just not all misery and crying all the time. People are very funny and resourceful in prison. It's a very lively place. And I think there are reasons for that. Like, your personality is one of the only forms of currency you have in prison, since everything is taken away from you. Some people have money on their books, you know, to shop at the canteen. Many people don't. They have their ability to cajole and persuade and seduce and entertain and threaten and manipulate. So personality is a premium. And I've found people to be incredibly funny. In my own life, the people I knew who were always getting arrested and having to deal with the criminal justice system, and the people I know who are there now, there's always room for humor. I mean, even as your options reduce down, then that becomes your life. And there are people who are still willing to insult a cop to get a few laughs out of their peers, even if it means getting thrown into administrative segregation. And so I needed to tap into that kind of humor. It was really important to me, because if I wasn't doing it, I wasn't tapping into the truth of the place.
Yeah, I like the description of the actual Mars room. If you showered, you had a competitive edge. If your tattoos weren't misspelled, you were hot property.
Oh, well, yeah, that's the club that she worked at. It's actually kind of based on a real place in San Francisco that doesn't exist anymore that was very much like that. Like, the girls who worked there always thought John Waters should come and film a movie there, because he could find a natural set of characters.
Now, you narrated the audio version of the book. How was that process?
It was really fun. I really wanted to do it. I hadn't narrated my previous two books. There's something about the delivery of a professional narrator that's just quite different than the delivery of an author. And probably there are people out there who prefer the professional narratives. It's very slick and smooth, and they change intonation when they speak from the voice of a different character. But I like things read by the author if the author is a good reader. I felt with this book like I really wanted to do the narration, partly because over the last year that I was editing it, I was reading sentences out loud because the sentences are somewhat vocal. They're short, they're syncopated, they're declarative. Romy has a kind of tough tone, and I knew how each line should be delivered. I mean, at least by me, if I were narrating, I felt like I could do it. And almost like I was inadvertently practicing as I was editing the text, because when you read out loud, you can really see what's extraneous and how the rhythm and the syntax is working. So I asked if I could narrate, and they hemmed and hawed and considered me, and finally they agreed. And it was really fun to do, strangely. I didn't realize that they have you read on a Kindle, which I'd never held an electronic book in my hand before. But it makes perfect sense for that format because you don't have to stop and flip pages. You're just in this seamless river of text that you move lightly with your fingers, and it makes no noise. And you take a break when you want to, and they have an audiobook producer and a sound engineer there. And they listen to it. I never had to listen to it, but they were quite fun to work with. And I think I'd practiced so much that I didn't really have to do any retakes, so it was actually easy. It was fun to do.
And along with the audiobook, there are accessible versions. It's available also in Braille.
It's incredibly lucky for authors to have their books repackaged in ways that can reach different audiences. It's amazing that you do it in Braille. I actually was just with my cousin last week who has lost the sight in one eye and may lose the sight in his other eye, but he's already feeling like he can't really read with monocular vision. And also I grew up with a grandmother who had polio and had a disability and was a tireless activist for disability rights in the 1960s, 50s and 60s, very early. So by the 70s, when I was a child, I was used to this kind of group of campaigners that she had aligned herself with. And it was really her life's work, in a way, to make disability rights front and center. She was in a wheelchair. And so accessibility of many different kinds is hugely important to me. You know, it's an ongoing struggle in our life to be more aware ourselves and to make other people more aware of what ableism is and who's being excluded.
Rachel Kushner, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much for having me and for your questions.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB Helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. And our final locked up book takes us back to non-fiction by the late Victor Gregg, writing with Rick Stroud. Victor was a prisoner of war, and he had a remarkable escape. Available in the Talking Books library now is
Rifleman, A Frontline Life from Alamein and Dresden to the Fall of the Berlin Wall, by Victor Gregg with Rick Stroud. When we inspected the truck, the whole of the rear tailboard and one side of the vehicle was a mass of holes. How did we get away with it? None of us had so much as a scratch. Pure luck. The next morning, we were given a lecture by Wingy. When the enemy advanced, our job would be to keep in contact at all times, to watch what they were doing and report it back. but on no account were we to mix it with them.
I spoke to Victor Gregg and his co-author Rick Stroud at the Boswell Book Festival.
Born into a working-class family in 1919, Victor Gregg, enlisted in the Rifle Brigade at 18, was sent to the Middle East and saw action in Palestine. Following service in the Western Desert and at the Battle of El Alamein, he joined the Parachute Regiment and in September 1944 found himself at the Battle of Arnhem. When the paratroopers were forced to withdraw, Gregg was captured. He attempted to escape, but was caught and became a prisoner of war, sentenced to death in Dresden for attempting to escape and for burning down a factory. Only the Allies' infamous raid on the city the night before his execution saved his life. And we'll hear about that in a moment. I asked Victor how he came to write his life story.
Well, it mainly came about, I was about 80, and I was living in Somerset. And my young, not my sons, not my daughters, but my grandchildren would keep on coming up asking me, what did I do in the war, as they always do. And I'd never told anybody. To me, the war was a subject which was taboo. I never mentioned anything. So at that time, computers started coming on the scene. So I sat down. It took me about 3 months to write 130,000 words. There's nothing false in it. No inventions. I didn't have to invent characters. I didn't have to make up sort of scenes or problems or anything like that. Everything came out, put down as I remembered it. And that went on until one day, some years later, we was living in Winchester. And Rick had been writing a book about Alamein. He was sort of looking things up, you know. And he had contacted two officers who I served with. Two officers, one of them was on the last draft with me, the last draft that left England before the war to India. So they said, well, don't talk to me, don't talk to us, go and talk to Vic down in Winchester. He's one of the last left alive. He'll tell you everything. So we went down the pub. In the end, I said, come back home with me and I'll give you a manuscript. You can take it home and take what you want out of it and throw the rest in the dustbin. So he took it home. But unfortunately, his wife, who had a senior post at Bloomsbury, happened to read it. And 2 weeks later, I was up in Bloomsbury signing my life away. So that's the history. That's the brief history of how Rifleman started.
Rick Stroud is a writer and television director, and earlier in his career, he was the associate producer of Brideshead Revisited. He's the author of The Book of the Moon and The Phantom Army of Alamein, How the Camouflage Unit and Operation Bertram Hoodwinked Rommel. And it was to Rick that Victor handed that manuscript. Rick, what was that like?
Getting the manuscript for the book that ended up being called Rifleman was a very, very exciting moment because I'd only met Vic for about half an hour and we'd been chatting, and then he suddenly said, my biography, my autobiography, and it's called The Survivor. I couldn't believe it because this was a first-hand account of most of the major events of the Second World War and all of the major events that I was interested in, which were Alamein, the Battle of Arnhem, which has obsessed me ever since I was 15 and I'm 68 now, and the terrible bombing of Dresden. So it was a major event in my life.
So, Victor, how did you end up in Dresden under a death sentence?
I was in at the start in North Africa. We was in Palestine when war was declared. And we went right the way through that. And then at the end of the Middle East campaign at Cape Bon, they was going to send the battalion back to Palestine. And I didn't want to go back. And at that time, they was asking for volunteers for this new parachute battalion. So I volunteered for that. Anyway, we went into Italy via Taranto, and then I landed up at Arnhem. I was captured at Arnhem and got eventually into this work camp, which was on the outskirts of Dresden.
But you escaped three times.
On the third time I tried to escape, they kept recapturing me. And the chap in charge of the camp, he was an old German naval officer, he decided, he said, I've got a punisher. He said, He said, I admire your persistence, he said, but I've got to punish you, so you've got to go and work in a soap factory. Well, nobody wanted to work in his soap factory because it was 6 kilometres away, and this was February, and the snow was about 2 feet deep, and you had to walk it all there and all wet all the way back. See? So on the second day, he said, I'll come up with something for you, Victor, he says. You can have these wooden clogs. He gave me these wooden clogs, about 1.5 inch thick wooden soles on them. He says, they'll keep your feet dry walking through the snow. When I got there, I was put in charge of shoveling this stuff, this sort of soap powder, into this big vat. And there was a big Yorkshire bloke who was already there. So the two of us were working together. So on the other side of this big workplace, there were some Italian prisoners building a wall. And they had a big pile of cement piled against it, and it was the same colour as this soap powder. So we decided to fill the wheelbarrow with cement and see what happened. And, of course, what happened was that when the German supervisor, it was all done by touch, when he thought, well, you know, take it out of the mixer, put it in the trays, then in the oven, see, make the tablets. But it was too watery. You couldn't make it out why it was too watery. So if you're going to leave it overnight and then start again in the morning. And in the morning, of course, they come down, he pulls the lever down to start all the machinery. Of course, nothing moved, did it? Everything was solid. So the wiring all caught alight, and it was a very old building. So all the roof went up, and they quickly sussed the two of us out and sent for the local police. They come up, and as we drove away, the old building collapsed inwards. So we had to go into Dresden, go in front of this bloke, this German officer, and he said, I can't do nothing about it. He says, sabotage. He says, you'll be shot tomorrow. That's it, see? Take them away. So they took us away to this place, right in the centre, bullseye. Right in the centre of Dresden. Right in the centre of Centerstadt. And there was about 300 or 400 people in there. It was crammed tight. It was terrible, it was. And that night they came over and bombed it. This big blaster bomb come and landed outside the building and pushed it all in. And I got away with it. It picked me up and threw me over the other side of the building, and I was covered up in masonry and stuff like that. But I was one of the 30 or 40 who escaped annihilation on that night, and so that's why I didn't get executed. So that's the answer to that question. I'll wait with trepidation for the next one.
Right, OK, just one. What's kept you going?
What's kept me going? I ain't got a clue. I just haven't got a clue how I'm still alive. Probably it's a mental attitude, half of it. I never worry about things. Life has taught me that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And you get in a situation, you cannot do anything about it. You've got to overcome the situation the best way you can. So don't worry. Carry on. So there's various things. I don't know. I don't feel any sign even now of impending disaster or termination. I just realise if I'm walking downstairs, I've got to walk down very, very carefully because I'm liable to trip up. So, yeah, I suppose it's like everything else. Why have I survived? How have I survived when all my mates, all my friends, they've all kicked it, they're all dead, and I'm still here? It's just a matter of luck, I think, and I'm grateful for it.
I left Waterloo and walked, weighed down by all my worldly belongings, all the normal army kit. I lugged it through all the familiar places, across Waterloo Bridge, up the Aldwych, along Kingsway and on to Russell Square, my old stamping grounds. My impatience to get home finally got the better of me, and I took a tube to the Caledonian Road. In no time, I was outside the two small rooms on the second floor of our tenement house in Ellington Street. By now I was a bag of nerves, but the love I was greeted with is something I shall never experience again.
Rifleman by Victor Gregg and by Rick Stroud is available from RNIB Talking Books now. All RNIB libraries, including Talking Books, are free, and you can download books on RNIB Overdrive or receive them on a Daisy CD or USB stick. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/books. And finally, on today's show, some non-prison-related but brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Firstly this week, we have customer favourite Kathy Kelly. Her book, The Family Gift, was donated to RNIB Library by Orion.
The boxes are going to break me. I can see that now. Up until this point, everything was about filling them, closing the house sale, and making sure the movers got every single item, every single box from our old house installed in their truck. But at this moment, exhausted from being up since 5:30, rushing round, tidying and stuffing everything left into boxes, I have a sudden horrible realisation. I will now have to unpack it all. It's a Friday mid-afternoon in May. Dan and I and 4 house movers, who had been looking singularly underwhelmed with the uncool and inexpensive contents of our old house, are staring at our new one. They've stopped arguing about sports, so I think they might be mildly impressed. Number 9 Rowan Gardens was a tall, narrow house with on-street parking, and the garden, such as it was, consisted of 2 olive trees in pots outside the front door. Kalinch House, I know, a name and not a number, is set in its own 1/8 of an acre, boasts several trees, and is in a whole different league for myself and Dan.
Freya has a big, messy, wonderful family. She has an exciting career as a celebrity chef. She has a new home that makes her feel safe. But behind the happy front, Freya feels pulled in 100 directions. Life has thrown Freya some lemons, and she's learned how to juggle. But she's keeping a secret from her family, and soon something is going to start crashing down. All families have their struggles and strengths, so can Freya pull everyone and herself together when they need it most?
Our new home, I think, looking up at it from the drive, which is half gravel, half weeds. It's a slightly run-down Edwardian red brick that needs more than a lick of paint to dolly it up. In fact, it probably needs a live-in handyman who works for free to fix all the wonky doors, fallen-off skirting boards, and the gap between the bottom of the kitchen door and the garden, which must be heaven if you're a mouse. But, this is the important bit, it's a structurally sound, detached house with its very own gate and, really importantly, high walls. We will be safe in this new house with the big wall. Safe. Dan puts his arm around me and I lean into him, determined not to let unpacking anxiety, I'm sure it's a disease, get the better of me. Freya, you're right. Buying this is a sound economic decision, he says in his "Are we mad?" voice. And I laugh, because Dan always makes me laugh, even when I know he's saying this to convince both of us that we haven't put ourselves into unmanageable debt for a detached house with issues. I don't know why they say economists aren't sexy, I tease, to change the subject, because they so are. Dan slides one large hand up under my now dirty t-shirt and encounters bare skin. We need to christen this house, he murmurs. Can we wait till the movers are gone? I deadpan back. Or do you want an audience? Because the gravel will be uncomfortable, and phone footage of the whole thing could ruin my career.
The Family Gift by Kathy Kelly is narrated by Caroline Lennon and runs for 11 hours, 2 minutes.
For Karen Slaughter fans, we have After That Night, which was given to us by HarperCollins.
She wasn't sure what terrified her most, having the darkest parts of her life exposed in an open courtroom, or breaking her promise to Danny. Dr. Linton? Maritza was finally ready to proceed. She walked back to the stand, holding a sheet of paper between her hands. She didn't offer it to Sarah. She kept it close to her chest, trying to build suspense. The trick worked. Sarah could feel the jury's attention coming into focus when Maritza said, "I'd like to take a step back for a second, if you don't mind. Review something from earlier today." Sarah nodded, then, for the court reporter's benefit, said, "Okay." "Thank you." Maritza turned, walking past the jury box. 5 women, 4 men, a typical Fulton County mixture of white, black, Asian, and Hispanic. Sarah could see their eyes following the lawyer, some studying her face, some trying to scrutinize the sheet of paper.
15 years ago, Sarah Linton's life changed forever when a celebratory night out ended in a violent attack that tore her world apart. Since then, Sarah has remade her life. A successful doctor, engaged to a man she loves, she's finally managed to leave the past behind her. Until one evening, on call in the ER, everything changes. Sarah battles to save a broken young woman who's been brutally attacked, but as the investigation progresses, led by GBI Special Agent Will Trent, it becomes clear that Danny Cooper's assault is uncannily linked to Sarah's.
Maritza took her yellow legal pad off the table and placed it on the podium. She had her pen in her hand. She slipped on her glasses and looked down at her notes. She wasn't Douglas Fanning, but she was damn good at her job. Maritza didn't need a jury consultant to tell her how to dress any more than Sarah did. They were both women who'd come up in male-dominated fields and had both figured out that, for better or worse, their appearance mattered more to a jury than what came out of their mouths. Hair pulled back to show they were no nonsense, light makeup to show they were still making an effort, glasses on to show intelligence, modest skirt and matching blazer to show they were still feminine, heels no more than 2 inches high to show they weren't trying too hard. Show, show, show. Maritza looked up at Sarah, saying, "Before the lunch break, you walked us through your education and credentials, but to remind the jury, you're both a board-certified pediatrician and a board-certified medical examiner, correct?"
"Yes."
"And the night Danny Cooper was brought into the emergency department, you were employed by the Grady Healthcare System as the attending pediatrician, but currently, today, you are employed by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation as a coroner, correct?"
"Technically, my title is medical examiner." Sarah allowed herself to look at the jury. They were the only people in the courtroom whose opinions mattered.
After the Night by Karen Slaughter is narrated by Jennifer Woodward. It runs for 16 hours and 55 minutes.
The historical fiction titled The Miniaturist by Jesse Burton was a huge success, both as a book and a TV show. The sequel is The House of Fortune, and it was donated by Bloomsbury.
At 18, Thea is too old to be celebrating birthdays. Rebecca Bosman turned 30 in December and never mentioned it. That is sophistication. In bed, in the dark January dawn, Thea shivers under her sheets. She can hear her aunt and Cornelia bickering down in the salon, and her father dragging away the table for breakfast on the rug. They always start Thea's birthday sitting on that rug. Relentless tradition, the fun of pretending to be adventurers, making do with the provisions they have mustered. These days, it is a pitiful conceit, because none of them have left the city walls for years. Also, what's wrong with the table? They've clung on to the good one. They should use it. Adults use tables. If Rebecca Bosman had to endure a birthday breakfast, she would have a table. But Thea cannot tell them any of this. Cannot bear to go downstairs and see Aunt Nella turn away, tugging the tatty paper chains she's surely hung off the huge iced windows. Her father, staring at the threadbare rug. Cornelia, her old nursemaid, gazing forlornly at the little poffert she's been up all night finessing. Thea has no wish to tip them into sadness, but she doesn't know how to extricate herself from this role they have put her in, their collective child.
In the golden city of Amsterdam, in 1705, Thea Brandt is turning 18, and she is ready to welcome adulthood with open arms. At the city's theatre, Walter, the love of her life, awaits her, but at home in the house on the Herengracht, all is not well. Her father Otto and Aunt Nello argue endlessly, and the Brandt family are selling their furniture in order to eat. On Thea's birthday, also the day that her mother Marin died, the secrets from the past begin to overwhelm the present. Nella is desperate to save the family and maintain appearances, to find Thea a husband who will guarantee her future, and when they receive an invitation to Amsterdam's most exclusive ball, she is overjoyed. Perhaps this will set their fortune straight. And indeed, the ball does set things spinning. New figures enter their life, promising new futures, but their fates are still unclear.
She might have become a woman today, but joy in this household is laced always with a fear of loss. And here it comes, in the form of food, the sweet spiced waft from downstairs arriving underneath her bedroom door. The puffets infused with rose water, no doubt spelling Thea's name in case she should forget. Cornelia's fluffy cumin eggs to keep her prisoner. Hot buttered rolls to warm her up. Delft butter as a treat, and a thimble of sweet wine for the adults. Thea throws back the sheets, but still cannot bring herself to get up, feeling no lift of her spirit at the promise of special butter. The only thing she can hope for is that they have bought her tickets to the Schoberg so she can see Rebecca Bosman perform again. And afterward, when the play is over, she can steal away to Walter. He is the only person who can propel her from her covers. Soon, Thea thinks, soon we will be together, when everything will feel right. But for now, prolonged and stale childhood.
Jesse Burton's The House of Fortune runs for 12 hours and 17 minutes and is narrated by Madeline Mantalk.
For those who enjoy psychological thrillers, we have the new book by Julia Heberlin, Night Will Find You, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
I lay my palm flat on the picture. It covers a pile of bones. I think her name starts with A or E. Definitely a vowel. She is embedded in the earth like a forgotten shipwreck on the ocean floor. The voices of two men drift under the closed door. A childhood best friend who believes I brush shoulders with ghosts, and a stranger who thinks I'm a joke. Both are cops. Both are agitated. I wish they'd burst in, get it over with, tell me to continue or not with this dead girl lying under my chewed pink fingernails.
Vivie Boucher, respected scientist and reluctant psychic, saved a boy's life after a premonition when she was a child. That boy is now a Texas police officer. He convinces Vivie to help him solve a high-profile cold case, working alongside Detective Jesse Sharp, a skeptic of anything but fact. 3-year-old Lizzie Solomon disappeared in broad daylight from her home. A body was never found, but the child's mother, Nicolette, is in prison for the disappearance, loudly proclaiming her innocence. When a popular podcaster hears of Vivi's involvement in the case, his conspiracy theories about the missing child and Vivi's background have an army of fans hanging on every dangerous word. But then it becomes clear there may be a kidnapper or killer still on the loose. Vivie knows there's more to lose than her reputation, because the difference between the truth and a lie can mean life or death. A sharply observed psychological thriller, Night Will Find You explores the dangerous meeting of conspiracy theories and our need to believe, and the line between fact and what we can't explain.
The walls in this police interview room make me ache from the inside out. I've been here often enough lately that I've memorized every scar in this room. The ominous black marks on the walls, the handcuff scratches on the metal table, the tile floor with the big chip and brown stain. I stare at a pale crescent line drawn between my thumb and forefinger, one of 9 scars on my own body. It seems like a lot for a 28-year-old who still wouldn't call herself brave. My friend Mike feels differently about my fearlessness. He has enticed me to this interview room 5 times in the last couple of months, late at night, an open secret in the police station. I overheard my nicknames from 2 cops gossiping at the sink while I sat in a bathroom stall. Mike's medium, the poltergasm. The rumor is, after I look in my crystal ball of the dead, Mike throws me on this table and cheats on his wife. All I've ever seen in a crystal ball is nothing. Mike would never cheat, not with me. He'd arrange this table the same way every time, with 2 chilled cans of Coke and a pile of unresolved case files, and then he'd leave. No more than 10 files, only photographs. That was our agreement. That's all of the dead I could take in one sitting. At my request, no details of the crimes. I'd examine each of Mike's files carefully, sticking a post-it on the outside after I closed it. Many times, the word I wrote was nothing. Mike didn't care. He said cops were thrilled with 40% accuracy on psychic tips and that I was averaging 42.
Night Will Find You by Julia Haberlin runs for 10 hours and 37 minutes, as read by Carissa Vacker. And that's it for today's Read On. Thanks to everyone who took part. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, the show is available as a podcast. Over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'm available on Twitter at @talking_books, and remember, I'm back every day with our sister show, Talking Books. The full schedule is at rnib.org.uk.